Hello, kids. Bat Segundo here, and I must profoundly object to Daniel Levitin's claims that there are six kinds of song. For when my ex-wife left me, there was only one kind of song that played in the Segundo Hi-Fi. And it was the most diabolical kind of song indeed, wholly unacknowledged by Mr. Levitin in his book, but sung by one of the most evil men that I have ever encountered through a set of speakers. I shall not utter the scoundrel's name, but I can tell you that his name rhymed with very sweet and low. To my regret, this man has not been assassinated, much less halted from entry into recording studios. The man's presence was so terrifying that I was forced to give up music altogether. Perhaps there will come a time in which someone like Mr. Levitin can persuade a man of my low standing that there are indeed other musical options.
Okay, so I am here with Daniel Levitin, who is most recently the author of The World in Six Songs. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing all right. First off, you've set up a very interesting taxonomy in this book. It splits songs into six categories: friendship, joy, comfort, knowledge, religion, and love. But I'm curious about songs that might straddle the fence. I mean, what about individual variation? For some people, they may perceive a song that we may all construe as religion, or they may find joy in that, and vice versa, and the like. Are you more concerned with neurological response, or how do we come to terms with a specific song or categorize it amongst these six categories
well,
like this?
I'm flexible. The
good.
As I say in the book, a given song can certainly appear in more than one category.
Sure.
So the categories aren't rigid, and throughout time, a song's meaning may change, or your individual interpretation or use of a song may be different.
Yeah.
You may find in a song that was originally intended as a funeral song, in China, because you're not familiar with Chinese scales and music and the idiom of Chinese music, you may find great joy in it, and and that's fine.
Or you could just be a black-humored type of person,
sure,
and find funeral songs quite joyful.
Yeah, no, the idea isn't that the categories are exclusive,
yeah,
but the idea is that of all the different kinds of music that we have, we as a species tend to use music in six distinct ways. And a song can be used in more than one way.
Yeah. But I mean, going back to the one element of my question of whether this is really about neurological response versus how a song is perceived in society, I mean, where does this...
Well, the way that I came up with the six categories was based both on neurological and anthropological work.
Yeah.
So when, for example, at one point I thought that there were 8 categories.
What were the other two?
Well, so out of friendship, I had friendship and I had social bonding as separate categories. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the brain response, it turns out that you get nearly identical brain reactions to when you listen to music. The chemical that's released, oxytocin, is a chemical that induces trust and causes you to bond with others. It's the same chemical that's released when you have an orgasm.
Yes, exactly. I was about to mention that.
So people, I mean, if you want to, you know, follow John Lennon's advice, people who come together have this mutual hit of oxytocin at around the same time, and it really does, I mean, there's a chemical basis for the mutual orgasm thing. But because music causes this, it seemed as though friendship and social bonding were really two ways of looking at the same thing.
Yeah.
From a neurological side.
Got it.
And at another point, there was an extra category for ceremonial and ritual songs separate from religious songs. But I came to believe from anthropological research that they were, you know, they were really serving the same function.
Well, you say you had 8 categories to begin with. I'm wondering how you whittled it down to these 6 general ones. I could imagine that you may have had 56 at one point.
Oh, sure.
Right.
I mean, somebody the other day asked me, you know, how difficult are you finding it to defend this audacious theory you have of the 6 categories? And I said, well, I don't find it difficult at all, because the way science is done, you don't start out saying, oh, I'm going to try to find support for this. I think I should have 6 categories, and I'm going to try support try to find support for it. That the way you do science is you look at the data, and the data have a story to tell.
Yeah.
There's something latent in there. There's some structure.
Yeah.
And it's the scientist's job to pull that out, whether it's nine planets or eight planets, or you know, whether it's three kinds of elementary, you know, quantum particles or whatever it is.
Five senses, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's there.
Seven wonders of the world, six songs.
Yeah. So the idea was that seven basic plots for stories, right?
Exactly. We could be here all day.
Yeah. The data sort of pointed to these natural categories, and there were some judgment calls to make about whether friendship and social bonding are the same thing.
Yeah.
Whether ritual and ceremony are the same thing.
All right, well, then we have six categories. Can you name a single song that actually can be applied for all six categories? Have you considered examples along these lines?
I'm sure if you gave me enough time that I could.
You have 30 seconds.
Well, I'm going to go with I Walk the Line.
Huh.
Because I think it's a very rich song.
Yeah.
In the book, I make the case that it crosses two categories.
Really walks the line here.
Right. I mean, at the surface level, I believe that it looks like a love song. The guy's singing to the woman that he loves, or, you know, because you're mine, there's a you in it, and he's singing to her, because you're mine, I walk the line, you know, I'm not cheating on you. But the point I make in the book is that really, I think at a deeper level, he's not really singing it to her. He's singing it to himself. It's like a musical string around his finger, reminding him of all he has at stake here. I find it very, very easy to be true. I'm alone when each day's through. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think you've been alone every night, and I don't think that you find it that easy to be true. I mean, I think it's a struggle. And he's reminding himself of all that he has at stake. That's a knowledge song, self-knowledge. Now, at the same time, I think that you could argue that there's an element of comfort here. People who have been in a similar situation take comfort in hearing it expressed this way. I listen to music often because the songwriter helps me to understand feelings that I haven't been able to articulate. The right song comes on, aha, that's how I feel. And I find that comforting.
I'm wondering also if identifying a song by the six categories is a matter of identifying perhaps a dominant and a recessive category for each particular song, whether
sure.
perhaps a stronger song is more likely to have at least two categories attached to it, or maybe some songs are just utterly simple and are intended to just serve one purpose. I mean, it all depends, I suppose, on any number of factors. Maybe you can talk about this a little bit.
Well, I think the other aspect of it is that it's not that the songs themselves fit into six categories. It's that these are the six ways that people use music.
Yeah.
The six ways that people have had music in their lives, and the six ways that they use music to communicate with one another.
I wanted to ask you, actually, about comfort songs. You cite specific personal examples, but I actually want to give you a personal example that I had as a teenager. I had a tendency to blast Nine Inch Nails quite loud. It was a comfort song because, people would fall down on the back. Now, it was a comfort song to me because I would listen to this man who was utterly depressed, and I'd say to myself in a sad state, saying, oh, well, you know what? There's someone who is worse off than me.
Yeah.
And it was a way for me to corral my emotions with reason. However, the examples that you use in the comfort chapters tend to be people who are looking just for emotional comfort, but not this association between reason and emotion. And I was wondering if it's very possible that we could be talking about two subspecies of comfort songs here.
What do you mean the connection between reason and emotion?
Well, by listening to Trent Reznor, I would be able to immediately understand that my own particular emotions were somewhat folly in some sense, and I would then kind of, yeah. The rational part of my
kind
of
like
my teenage brain would kick in, and I'd say, oh, you know, I'm beating myself up here for no reason.
Kind of like listening to Morrissey.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to kill myself.
Any of the emo.
Everything's bad tonight.
Bands. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, should we draw two types of distinctions in comfort songs along these lines? I mean, we have to factor in emo here. I mean, we just
do. Absolutely. Well, and the sort of boomer example I use is of Janis Ian's At 17.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there's this suicidal girl that no one likes. She's ugly by her own admission. She has no friends. No one understands her. And the part of that I play up in the book is that, you hear a song like that, and if you're feeling somewhat that way, you know, we've all felt that way. We've all felt unattractive. We've all felt as though no one likes us. You know, we don't have any friends, especially in high school. The part of it I play up in the book is that you hear that and you realize I'm not alone at the edge of the cliff. Yeah. Someone else is there with me. Yeah. I'm understood. Someone understands me. Now, your point that social comparison theory is what a psychologist would call it. I'm bad off, but I'm not as bad off as that.
Yeah.
That's part of it. You could find the same thing with the Janisian song or with any of these, even the boomer songs, you know, whether it's Joni Mitchell or anyone complaining about having been done wrong or.
But I think about the example you use, the personal example of Eddie the dishwasher pulling a knife because someone, the manager tore out his mixtape. He was absolutely convinced that this song was the representation of his brother. This was his only way to get through it, and it's a rather stirring episode in your book. And so that's why I'm curious about this particular distinction. Maybe what we're talking about here is that essentially we have a comfort song, and it really boils down to the individual and how they choose to parse it or choose to find comfort in it. Is that what we're kind of talking about?
Yeah, I think that two things that are implicit and that maybe are worth making explicit are that the range of human emotions is probably not finite. I mean, and they're combinations of emotions. We don't simply feel most of the time one emotion at a time. We feel combinations of emotions. We get these bittersweet feelings, happy and sad at the same time. Turns out music is better at conveying this complex mix of emotions than straight language is. I can play you a few notes and you can feel happy and sad at the same time. It's hard for me to convey that or to induce that with plain language. The other thing is that there's great individual differences across people. Two people react to events very differently, the same event, the same song. One person's favorite will be another person's, horrible earworm that they can't stand. So I think the idea is that within each of these categories there's going to be or each of these kinds of music, or any given musical example, there's going to be a range of reactions and a range of experience.
Since you mentioned earworms, I have to bring this up with you as well. You do categorize advertising jingles for children, such as the Slinky song, in the joy quality, the joy category. And I have to go ahead and play Doubting Thomas here, because many of these advertising jingles, they get stuck in your craw, that become these terrible earworms inevitably don't cause joy, they cause terror. What is this really, again, is this a question of neurological response? Can these really be sufficiently categorized as joy songs if they're really terrible and if they're just so annoying? If you're standing in an elevator and you have to listen to the world's worst Muzak imaginable.
Well, I think you're taking more literally than I intended.
Okay.
The idea that a song gets saddled with a label that it can't shake for the rest of its life. My point was that music is used to express joy. And in fact, a lot of dance music, and especially if you look at indigenous cultures, a lot of what they do in their ceremonial rites and rituals is to just express appreciation, joy, happiness. You can hear the ebullience in their singing and you can see it in their dancing. And advertisers have latched on to this quality of music. And they've latched on, although they probably didn't know the neurochemical basis of it, they latched on to the fact that when we hear music that we like, we get dopamine, happy juice. We get this chemical that makes us feel good. And so they write songs, many, many advertising jingles, maybe even the majority of them, try to capture this sense of extreme happiness. If you buy my product, you're going to be really, really happy, whether it's Coca-Cola or Ford or a children's toy, made out of a spring. Yeah. And they're trying to capture this joy, and they're trying to sell you joy. Now, whether the song actually conveys joy in you or not, that's a function of how effective the advertisers were. And of course, any song, you could take the greatest, happiest, most joyful song in the world, and you can feel that way about it. But then if it's accompanied by some tragic episode, your life experience is going to shift. Yeah. and it's no longer going to do that for you. It'll forever be associated with that horrible thing.
I want to go and talk about neurochemicals because I think that this is really intriguing. You point out that serotonin levels rise when we listen to music, but also certain chemicals and neurotransmitters actually rise according to specific genre. For example, techno cortisol levels rise. But I have to, again, sort of play Doubting Thomas here and ask whether, well, we're an adaptive species. We are going to look for ways of getting our serotonin levels up, whether that is music or whether that is essentially eating carbs. And then also for the cortisol, well, I know that there was a study done by Emma Adam where she pointed out that lonely people had a tendency to wake up in the morning with an increase in cortisol. And so I'm wondering, is music really absolutely necessary? Is it just there? I mean, why? This goes back to the Steven Pinker auditory cheesecake controversy, but I am quite curious about how you can defend it as a sort of an essential part of being when there are other things that we can do to keep our serotonin levels rising and to keep our cortisol levels rising in other circumstances and the like.
Well, your question is very rich. There are a lot of different ways to go here. To begin with, the world and evolution work on a principle of redundancy. There are lots of ways to get things done. And that's because the world has a certain chaotic component, and you can't always count on, you can't always rely on one way to always be there to accomplish a particular biological need. So, I mean, you look at food. I mean, what a crazy system we have. You have to eat a bunch of different foods in order to get the vitamins you need.
Yeah.
You know, that's crazy. Why can't there just be one wonderful food, manna, you just eat that all the time, and it has, you know, well, how come evolution didn't figure that out? Well, the reason is because predators then some organism would come along and eat all of that, and it would be gone, and we would die. The idea is that the risk is spread out across a number of different foods and food sources. So if you want to take the big evolutionary angle on this, you know, if you ask why do we need music, or why do we need food, or why do we need air, or any of these things, it's probably the case that music isn't, if music were to be eradicated, I don't think we'd die. And if we never had music, I don't think we would not have gone this far. I'm not claiming that. But the fact is that we do have it, and we have had it. If you go to archaeological digs, some of the oldest artifacts you find, human-made artifacts, are musical instruments. And the evidence is that every culture throughout time and currently throughout the world has music. There's no culture at any time that we know of that lacked it. So it's been there, and it's been influencing us, and the book is sort of about the ways in which the brain prepared itself evolutionarily to create music, and the way in which our species exploited it.
Sure.
Now, you asked another question I'd like to tie up. You brought up Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker, for those who don't know, had this notion that music was not an evolutionary adaptation. Rather, it's an evolutionary byproduct of language, which is a plausible argument. I happen to think that the weight of evidence is on the other side, and I'll just give you a little taste of what I think the argument is.
Nice cheesecake references to this answer.
Stephen Mithen, the archaeologist, argues that Neanderthals communicated by means of something that was very music-like. Changes in pitch and rhythm. You can think of it sort of like the way the teachers in the Charlie Brown cartoons used to talk. No language, but a lot of melodic components, like that would have been Neanderthal language, according to Mithen. Something like it, anyway.
You have good scientific evidence on this.
Well, the evidence has to do with the evidence for Neanderthal language has to do with brains that they found and evidence that they had a similar region to ours that other primates lack, that has to do with language and motor movement and the ability to manipulate pitch and rhythm in vocal utterances. But it also has to do with Neanderthal culture. There are a number of things that they couldn't have done without being able to communicate in some fashion. But we can even set that evidence aside. Let's look at chimpanzees, our nearest genetic relatives, cousins. The way they communicate is largely through vocalization that you would have to call more musical than language, than linguistic. The panhoot of the chimpanzee consists of variations in pitch and rhythm, which by many definitions is music. They don't have anything like language. They don't have a particular grunt that stands for a certain symbol. They can't represent things that aren't there. They can't, you know, communicate about a banana that was here yesterday and isn't here today, or who took that banana. I mean, they can only talk about the present and their emotional states. And I say talk, but I mean they're basically singing. So for humans to have had language before music means that, evolutionarily speaking, Homo sapiens emerges. He forgets about the music that chimpanzees and perhaps Neanderthals have. He invents language. Homo sapiens emerges. They discover language somehow, forgetting the music that was their evolutionary heritage from chimpanzees, from other primates, from arguably from Neanderthals. And then they rediscover music later. I mean, the sequence of events just seems implausible. But, you know, it's open to debate.
Well, you also bring up David Huron's idea of the honest signal hypothesis. Now, his suggestion is that because or any organism needs to separate truth from lies in order to have an evolutionary advantage, that music itself is better because with music, it's difficult to fake sincerity. But we were talking about Muzak, advertising jingles, all sorts of insincere notions. Also, for example, Platinum Blue, which was mentioned in that New Yorker article by Malcolm Gladwell in 2006. It would seem to me that music is just as capable of being insincere as language. What of this?
Yes. Just as capable, I don't know. The thing is that there's always this evolutionary arms race between the cheaters and the detectors of the cheating. You know, the possum plays dead. Sooner or later, the bear is going to figure out this trick and not fall for it anymore. And sooner or later, in evolutionary timescales, could be any day now. And, you know, of course, there's this arms race with predators and their prey. And that's one of the things that evolution is best at. I mean, you know, moth turns a certain color to hide itself against a tree, and the predators figure it out, and it has to come up with something else. And so for the honest signal hypothesis to work, music doesn't have to be foolproof. It only has to be better than language. And I think that it is. I think that it's only relatively recently that advertisers have learned to exploit music. There is no evidence that, you know, King Solomon was, you know, trying to sell his people you know, some product based on a King David slingshot, you know, sold with a certain song. But the other thing about it is, I think most of us, in fact, are sensitive to when an advertiser is trying to dupe us. Yeah, I'm not going to buy that product. This advertiser is trying to manipulate me, and I don't want to be manipulated.
But then advertisers are also commissioning indie pop songs for their commercials so that they appear more genuine, and as such there becomes this chicken and egg argument as to what is sincere and what is not.
There is, and there's a lot of insincere pop music in the top 40. But
you think?
it's only insincere in a sense.
Yeah.
Having been a producer and having met some of these people, I gotta tell you, the astonishing thing is that they really believe in most of them. The vast majority of the really top successful ones, they really believe in what they're doing. They think that what they're making is art, and they are sincere about it. And what you're sensing, you know, when you take an artist who has a bunch of hit records over and over and over again, it's what they love to do. And it's sincerely what they consider to be a musical contribution. It's quite rare, even in the music industry, for an artist to say, this was all just a bunch of hype, I didn't really mean it. I mean, even to say it privately, to feel it. Because I think audiences are smart, basically. I think you can show them a painting and they don't have to know anything at all about paint or painting or art. And if it's a great work, they'll recognize it.
One last question. I know you have to get out of here, but I do have to ask you about this. What of the pernicious use of music? I think of, for example, Van Halen's Panama used to get Manuel Noriega out of his bunker, or even Metallica used in Abu Ghraib. Things like this are not touched upon in this book, and I think that they're just as important. Does this again come back down to neurological response and individual variation, or what of something that is decidedly not joyful uses of music that other people experience and are joyful?
Well, I do talk about the use of music to terrorize in the, paradoxically perhaps, in the chapter on friendship.
Yeah.
Because war songs and songs of battle are a part of the social bonding for the people who make it, right? And it has the intended effect of intimidating the people on the other side. So I think I take issue with you in that I think I do talk about, I don't know that I explicitly mention Manuel Noriega, but I certainly talk about
drum beats.
Drum beats.
You compare it to Lord of the Rings, but yeah, I mean, I'm talking...
And the Scottish Army,
yeah.
And yeah.
But there is a specific use...
I mean, Van Halen didn't write that music.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
with the intention of terrorizing people. And, you know, sure, we use it that way and as part of war, and war is part of a social bonding for us. You know, we're trying to eradicate those people who are not like us. That's what war is. Or we're trying to get them to conform to our ideas of what we think society and friendship and bonding should be.
But doesn't this pose some difficulty in learning to appreciate or understand music when it is essentially corrupted like this, whether it's for advertising, whether it's for war, whether it's for terror or whatnot? Or?
I don't know that, yeah, it creates some difficulty, but I think it's an important part of the endeavor. You have to look at all the ways people use music, even if they're using it in ways that it wasn't originally intended. Same thing with art, right? I mean, if you're looking for a theory of art, when Duchamp put the urinal in a gallery, sure. Or today there's, I forget his name, but he's got cows and formaldehyde inside plexiglass.
That sounds like a David Lynch.
Yeah, it does, but it's not.
Because he's done some cow work as well, right?
But, I mean, the cow wasn't intended to become a work of art, nor was the preserved cow. And the museum never intended itself to be the repository for dead cows. But these notions push at the boundaries of your conception, and they might cause you to come up with a new definition or reconceptualize what you are thinking about. And that's why the artists do it, of course. They're trying to provoke you into thinking differently. And I don't think the military was trying to provoke us into thinking differently when they played AC/DC and Van Halen in Panama. But I think those uses of music do need to be incorporated into any satisfying theory of what music is.
Well, I know you have to go, but Dan, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thank you.
All right.
Arena seats in a ringtone by the Saints. Don't know much about these weekend punks, but I've heard they are prone to faint. Street fights and open mics with a bar card to meet the beat. Anthems written for the discontent, but the eyeliner is key. The punks are riding.